This is an EdSmart podcast.
I'm Fiona Boyd. I'm CEO and co-founder of EdSmart, and I'm delighted and excited to welcome you today to an extraordinary opportunity of hearing from five leading principals of EdSmart schools in Australia and New Zealand, who today will talk to us about their experiences of leading their schools through the coronavirus pandemic. Which, for those of us who are in Melbourne, and I am, it's not over yet. And we'll be finding out as well what they see as the road ahead, some of the challenges and decisions they'll have to make in the next 6 months for the good of their school and good of the school community. So we'll be having a Q&A, a question and answer session at the end of this discussion and conversation. So feel free when we get there to send your questions through. And we would ask that you give your name, the school you come from, as well as your question. So let me introduce you today. We'll start with Philip Heath, AM Principal of Barker College in Sydney. Welcome, Philip.
Thank you very much, Fiona. Great to see you.
Great to see you. Christine Allen, Principal of Carmel College in New Zealand. And I believe Carmel College is administered under a system where the Ministry of Education runs your school. Is that correct?
We're a state integrated school. So we're owned by the Sisters of Mercy, but we actually operate under the state system.
Welcome, Christine. Also from New Zealand, excited as well to introduce Heather McRae from Diocesan School for Girls, which is an independent school in New Zealand. Welcome, Heather.
Ora tato, and it's very nice to be talking to everyone today. I hope you're all well.
Anthony Elmore, who has been in absolute a zone that was affected straight away, on the Gold Coast, principal of St Michael's College, which is part of the Brisbane Catholic Education Network. Welcome, Anthony.
Morning, Fiona, and good morning, everyone. It's lovely to be here.
And fantastic also to have Andy Muller, who is principal of Scotch Oakburn, a very venerable school in Launceston, Tasmania. Welcome, Andy.
Morning, welcome, everyone.
So where I'd like to start is just to tell you a little story. For other reasons, I was looking at the Barker College website and going through their community news in late February, early March, and I was looking for something else, but what I found was an absolute nugget, which was a constant news stream and newsletters and messages from the principal, Philip Heath, to his community explaining the novel coronavirus as he saw it from the school perspective, how it was going to affect the school community and what the school expected of students and parents and staff at that moment in time. And as we know, the moment's changed. So, Philip, at the time I made a mental note that I wanted to invite you and some other principals to talk to me about the experience when, you know, we were some way through it in order to understand it. So thank you for starting that idea off. So I'm just going to open more widely and put this to all of you, starting with Philip. But when did you know that this was not, 2020 was not going to be business as usual at your school?
Thanks, Fiona. And great to be here. I'm very honoured to be part of such a terrific group of outstanding people. I'm looking forward to learning lots and to people whose faces I can't see but who are online. Could I begin by acknowledging the work that you all do to keep your community strong and healthy and safe? The unsung heroes, really, of this whole crisis. The work that's going on in our communities is amazing. So Wadami Mitiga from Darug land in Sydney, a clan of the Eora people, and pay my respects to all First Nation peoples who might be watching and the First Nation peoples of your own schools. This emerging problem came to mind almost at Australia Day, around about the late part of January, when we were beginning to think about what do we do with our folk coming back from holidays and from China, notably. We have no overseas students at this school, but we have a large number of people who are first generation folk in this country and who have lived and settled in the North Shore of Sydney and put their children into this school. So we have a small boarding community as well, but they're all residents of Australia. So we began to think, what do I do about those cases? Because we're starting to hear about this virus. And then I sought some advice from some medicos who were in the community and tried to find out what is the virus, what does it mean, how communicable is it really, what are the risks involved in just business as usual. We happen to have a large music camp, 400 kids who attend the music camp that precedes the start of the term. Do I continue with that music camp? Do I isolate the students who've been travelling, and where have they been travelling, and which places do you privilege and not, and what are the optics of singling out China and the Chinese community? What damage does that do to community building? All of those thoughts were right on our minds. So right at the start, around about the 24th of January, we established a critical incident committee and a planning group. A critical incident usually has a life that starts, the incident occurs, you then review it, you implement all your changes, and then it closes. The critical incident committee is still meeting. We met yesterday to consider sports and how do we handle visitors to sports with the new round of community-based cases that have emerged because of the pub thing in southwestern Sydney. We played a little trial match last Saturday, and we received a phone call from that school that we hosted to say that one of their students had been in the pub for a meal and had played footy against us that weekend. So it's alive and well and strong and happening. And it became obvious that 2020 is going to be like a year like no other. Mm. And we started with the thinking rather than with the process. So your mind always jumps to what do you do? And what do you do at 9 o'clock on Monday morning and all that? But we actually tried to develop the discipline of stepping back and saying, it's not so much what do we do, but why do we do it? Like, what are we trying to do in doing things? So staying in line with the community, being a source of relative confidence about information, where there was a lot of information flowing and there was no single source of truth, trying to give the community some satisfaction that at least what we say is relevant to our people and is well informed, and then keep the information flowing, keep it in line with best health advice that we're hearing from state and federal authorities, sift out the political rhetoric and the politicisation of positions, and only deal with facts and information and take no view on what the politicians are saying, but listen more to the health experts. And then to adopt an attitude through the crisis that took the view that we're not just going to survive this, we're actually going to try to thrive in it, and then test ourselves in each decision against those three key principles. Why are you doing this? Stay in line, make it simple and clear, be a comfortable source of truth as so far as you possibly can, and then adopt the view that we want to grow, not just survive.
I hear a bit of resonance with what Anthony spoke to me a couple of days ago, which was he didn't with his team jump straight into action, instead actually went back to first principles and put the student at the heart of it. Maybe you could talk about that, Anthony.
Thanks, Fiona. Yes, certainly listening to what Philip was saying there does sound very familiar to a lot of our processes and the approach we adopted. One of the things that we did, certainly here on the Gold Coast, some of you may remember that the first cases that were reported here on the coast were in January, and then subsequent confirmations through the beginning of February. So we became very attuned to starting preparations and thinking about the impact on our families and our community at that time. What we had at the heart of all our decisions was around, firstly, as Philip was saying, trying to cut through the difference of opinions between the federal and the state government, because here in Queensland, of course, there's been that ongoing political difference going on, but trying to get to the heart of the core health message. So that was one of those things, trying to have that consistency of message. But we really took the view that we wanted to maintain that position of being hope-filled throughout what was going to happen, because we didn't know the complete impact at that time. The focus on the student to talk about saying, well, throughout whatever is going to happen, our core business is around two things, continuity of learning and about maintaining that connection and that sense of community. And that's where we started, and that's where we've held the line all the way through around saying, well, how do we ensure that we are maintaining support for our community, for our students, for our families, and then that continuity of learning, not continuity in the same format that has been happening in the past, but making sure that the students are still growing over the time that we, at that stage, was uncertain for us. So that's where we started. And then we went and sort of addressed and said, okay, well, what's the impact for us here? Because by that stage, the conversations that we were having here on the Gold Coast were even different from the conversations that they were having, an hour up the road in Brisbane. We had to, think a bit differently and think flexibly and broadly and really, put in place a number of different processes there to support our families. Because as soon as we started seeing more and more cases and then some of those restrictions coming in, the impact on our community was quite significant, and so we needed to plan to support those families.
What I pick up there is that being part of a network, there probably was directives coming to you from the network, and yet you were at the absolute front line with more advanced knowledge or data than they had, which is you probably had to sometimes fly blind in the snowstorm is what I say, is be that adaptive because you're actually ahead of where they can help you in your decision making.
Certainly, I would say that overall our system has been very responsive and we're very appreciative of the support. Noting that here on the coast, we were getting in the middle of it in, beginning of February, certainly the end of January, beginning of February, and the first real, correspondence and directives were coming out as a system in March. So we were probably a bit ahead of the ahead because we had to be for our community, for our families who were involved in the tourism industry, who had done a lot of travel over the holidays, as Philip's community had done also. And so really for us, we were starting to have significant numbers of people being tested and those different kinds of restrictions that were starting to come into play or advice and guidelines, us sort of as a school saying, well, what is the best for our students to safeguard our community? Because what was playing out on the Gold Coast was a bit different.
Christine, at Carmel College, I believe you had to devise your own plans as well, and sometimes they were a little out of sync with, I guess, a bureaucratic expectation. Maybe you could explain the 2 hours notice you had to jump to online learning and take your whole school online.
So a bit like Anthony and Philip, we had actually sort of was starting to anticipate that there would be a time when we would have to go online. And so we'd been having sort of weekly huddles with the senior leadership team, gathering information, seeing what was happening and sort of having a range of plans. And our sort of first principle was we have to maintain the well-being of our students and our staff. What will be the best solution for that? So it was about the learning, but always how are we going to actually maintain that well-being? Because there was a lot of fear out there and a lot of myths and things like that that were going. So we had, it was, I remember that day, I can't quite remember the date, but it was the Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Our Prime Minister was online saying to us, you know, what was going to happen. And then she sort of said at the last minute, I remember sort of 15 minutes of waiting saying, just say it, schools are shutting tomorrow. So as of tomorrow, there is no school. So we basically shut school at 3 o'clock. We had 1 hour's notice that this was happening. So while the cheer went up from the students because they didn't understand what was happening, the staff were like, what the heck are we going to do now? So we gathered as a group the following day. I just said, bring everybody back in. We need to put a plan in place. We had the skeleton outline of what we were going to do. We presented it to the staff the following day, gave them time to actually work together physically as a as departments to put that plan in action to see what would work, what would not work, and then dispatch them on their way. I mean, our advantage is that we are a bring-your-own-device school. We do a lot of our stuff online using the Google Suite, so it wasn't as hard a transition for us in terms of moving from on in class to online. But it was, and the other thing was, as Philip has said, keeping that sense of connection and engagement for our students. So part of our daily routine was we started every morning at 9 o'clock with half an hour's worth of engagement activities that our student leaders ran, and they were enormously engaging, and the kids rated those as one of the best things all day that they did. They looked forward to the activities that they did to build, to continue to keep that sense of community. And that's what was really important for us, to build those things.
Andy, at Scotch Oakburn, your school went out early to in online learning. So I'm just wondering, what advanced data did you have that informed that decision? And why did you go out on March 17 where others went out a bit later?
We were fortunate, like what Philip mentioned earlier, we were fortunate that we had a number of highly placed medical professionals in our immediate community, and I'd been in conversation with them, and I forget which one of the politicians who said something along the lines of, if you think this might happen next week, then you need to act today, sort of thing. So in the middle of March, we... in that conversation with various medical professionals, it became apparent that what we had to do was safeguard not just our community but our local community. Greater Launceston's about 75,000 people, and if we had something like a 1% incidence of COVID that resulted in people going into ICU, we would be flooded. Our ICU wouldn't be able to cope. And so we thought, well, if it gets into a school, maybe as the data was coming out, the students won't be immediately affected, but of course family members can be, et cetera. And we're now finding that there's a fair bit of that happening through Melbourne. And so we were preemptive because we were thinking bigger picture as well, and making sure that we were doing our bit. We knew that a bit like Christine was saying, we had the capacity. And we felt that rather than being in the situation of being told when you're going to go into e-learning, that we would make a really well-considered and smooth transition into it by giving staff a two-day window to prepare. So we called it on a Sunday night on the 15th of March. Staff had the Monday, Tuesday just to sort of put the finishing touches to their e-learning programs, and we commenced classes on Wednesday the 18th. So a number of factors there, and we got criticised a bit from one or two people about going early and closing the school when all the information from the Australian Chief Medical Officer was saying, you know, schools are safe places, you don't need to close schools. But we were listening to people who were here in Launceston and knowing what the capacity of our own hospitals is, as well as some of the other information that was coming out about transmission and how it can quickly spread, even if students themselves aren't particularly seriously affected. So that was sort of the rationale behind our decision. Every decision we've made, we've come back to the health and wellbeing of our students and our community. And when you boil it down to that, as no doubt with everybody who's here today and listening, when you boil it down to that, the obvious decision presents itself. But I remember waking up at 3 a.m. on Monday morning after we'd made the decision thinking, what have we done? We've just closed the school. We're the first school in the state to actually do this, move to e-learning. And for about half an hour, I lay there and went through it all again in my head and thought, no, we have to do this. But it was quite a moment.
sometimes being the first is really nerve-wracking.
I was buoyed by a couple of interstate colleagues and one you know very well, Stuart Davis at St Leonard's, and I'd been on the phone to Stuart and they were going through a parallel situation and coming to the same conclusion and making that decision to go early. So I gained some confidence from colleagues and sharing with peers.
Heather McRae at Diocesan School for Girls, you have a really had a unique way of coming to a similar decision, and it was based on the fact you were actually in Beijing in 2003 when SARS happened, and you had the experience of seeing how that rolled out then. Maybe you could walk us through, and you also have a background as a scientist, so it looked a little different to you, and you were prepared to go early and do something about this straight up, correct?
Yes, that's correct, Fiona. And I guess the experience in Beijing was hugely beneficial. And like a couple of you have said, having professionals in your community is very helpful as well, because, you know, they are seeing what it's like at the front of the health system and giving some really good advice. But certainly in January, I had just travelled back from the States, and we had our first staff meeting of the year, and I raised it with staff that this is something that is looming on the horizon, and if it gets out of China into a few other countries that it had done at that stage, then it would most certainly arrive in New Zealand. And I think a lot of the staff kind of looked at me and thought, you know, she's gone crazy over the holidays. But having the experience of SARS, the only thing that really worked during that particular crisis was locking down everything. You know, we had a construction on site at the time. We had to keep all of those construction workers on site, temperature test everybody. You know, there were lots of systems that were really helpful. And also a number of teachers that I was still in contact with were already running online programs in China. And so I talked to them about what that looked like. And of course, they were running them from New Zealand, and with the 5-hour time difference, they talked about, you know, the need to make sure that there was structure to programs, and also to make sure that there was a lot of personal contact to retain the relationships. So like Philip did, we very early on pulled out our pandemic plans that we are required to have in New Zealand, and formed a pandemic response committee very early on. And Philip said, ours is still meeting as well. So it was at that point that we then started to ask ourselves all the questions that needed to be looked at. Because we have a very international community, many of them were still travelling backwards and forwards to China and coming back after the holidays. So we put in place some requirements for parents and for girls to self-isolate at home before the government had announced that should be a thing that everyone did from those countries. So we as well came, as Anthony experienced, a bit of sort of criticism from the community. But I think many of them look back now and think actually they were really good decisions, because they did keep our community and our students safe. So there was a lot that everyone's talked about that resonated with us. And I'd also like to reinforce what Philip said around, you know, the number of people who may be listening in today who have done an amazing job for their communities. And I think for many of our girls who have experienced lockdown and online learning, they were just delighted to be back to school.
One thing that I did notice was that everyone learned how to do online learning on the run. And one good example, and we republished this, and thank you to Barker College for allowing that, but Jeremy von Einem, the head of curriculum at Barker College, wrote a fantastic story about what it was like to actually go through the first week of the whole school going to online learning. And the outcome of that was, well, it's not just school at home, and it's not the way we did it, we learnt an awful lot because it was just too much. We expected too much of everybody, the student, the teacher. Maybe, Philip, you could talk a little about that, and then we could have others tell me or tell each other what happened at your school in terms of online learning and how you had to adapt to find that sweet spot. Philip.
I like a number of other colleagues. We could all see the storm clouds about moving to online, storm clouds, if you will. So we did a few rehearsal events. So we had a few online days by way of rehearsal before we entered that space. And then we surveyed parents, staff and students and got some findings about this from the student experience that we were able to actually then unpack while we were still in face-to-face. We'd actually been forced into lockdown itself. We noticed what was going on in other places, in New Zealand, in Victoria, Tasmania, Queensland, watching particularly what the schools were doing. And so we're not in a kind of vacuum. We all influence each other, and the parents are very mindful of what's going on. So when we made the decision, a number of other schools locally were in the same space, making decisions, we thought, what does online learning look like? What are we trying to do? Is it to replicate the school day? That's the simplest thing, but in an online space. The findings of the survey from staff and students was absolutely exhausting and probably not sustainable. You can do it for a little while, but the demand on the teacher, the modality of learning, what on a screen, which can be up to 10 hours a day for a child, if you then add on their extra homework and other research exercises, is not reasonable. Mm. It doesn't speak to wellness or to thriving. It does not engage in the way that humans like to learn, which is essentially a social experience. We also discovered, if I could speak plainly, that some of our folk were just setting exercises and, here's your task list, like sort of worksheets, that just online worksheets. Here's what you've got to do. Off you go and do it, submit it, and that's called online learning. And so we had to circle back and amend all of that. And then we, using some of those findings, some fantastic, but nothing to do with me, it was really some very clever people here and in other places where they were networking well, came up with a completely different shape of the day. And a little bit like Christine, taking the view that a thriving child will learn. A child who feels that their teacher knows, likes them and values them as people will learn. So we tried to make that the heart of it. We created chunks of learning and then chunks of wellness, and then tried to make it as fun as we could. So we did some really very weird things using music and dance, and the staff are really good value. We lip-synced a whole lot of Hamilton music and pieces that were frankly quite indelicate and hope were never recorded and never see the light of day again. we tried we did a full version of Bohemian Rhapsody with the drama staff just because we could, because the kids were feeling the loss. And the big finding for us was that learning online is still valid, but it's different. So then how do you tell the parents what learning online looks like? And then how do you reshape that? So we went to a lot of trouble. And the ability to say, we've started this way, we're actually going to make that little change now because we've gotten better at that. is actually been a really important finding, because then it goes back to a point I was trying to raise earlier about building trust amongst your community. So who's the source of truth and do you trust them? Mm-hmm. And I think trust has been on trial in this last 6 months. Mm-hmm. It's a meta-narrative that to which we should return before mm-hmm. these days are over. What constitutes building trust mm-hmm. in communities? Mm-hmm. And how is that fostered? We found that telling people, we've started this way, we needed a change, we feel we can do it a bit better, come with us. Don't judge us, come with us and be part of that experience with us. That was a much more effective process. In the end, though, I was really concerned for the sustainability on staff. Because many of the feedback that comes from the energy that comes from human systems when we're all together was lacking online.
Andy, I saw a few nods from you. Do you have some similar things to say, or is there some divergence around your online learning experience?
A fairly similar experience to Philip, and we listened very much to what the students and the staff were saying, and again circled back to what's best for the health of our students and our staff. So we started e-learning on a Wednesday, and by the Friday week, so after 8 days of e-learning, students and staff were unanimously saying, we are exhausted, apart from the fact that we've got headaches, we're on a screen for hours and hours every day. So we called a screen-free day on the following Monday, on the 30th of March. And as we were leading into Easter, that meant that we started off with a three-day week. We had a five-day e-learning week, which, as I say, was exhausting by the end of it. Then we had 2 four-day weeks as we led into Easter. So for the 3.5 or 4 weeks that we were e-learning before the rest of the state was, we broke that up quite nicely in the end. And then that Easter break gave us the time to look at our whole school day and go, we can't simply replicate. We changed the timetable completely. We created large blocks of time in the middle of the day so students could get out and exercise and get off their screens, blocks of time between lessons so that they actually had time to stretch, get up, move around. And then we introduced a day of what we called P-learning, which was started the day with a quick catch-up with your tutor from a how-you-going sort of concept. And then it was the P could stand for, well, stood for pastoral because of our initial catch-up. And then it was passion, preparation, physical activity. It was anything that you could do away from your screen necessarily. So we went to a four-day, one-day sort of week. And didn't try to cram everything in as we did before. We just said, you know what, we've just got to try and, picking up on the comment earlier, we've got to thrive through this period and come out the other end feeling really good physically, mentally, not trying to just pick up your classroom teaching and plonk it down so in an e-learning space. So, it was a real eye-opener, which pushed a lot of people, including myself, into a very uncomfortable sort of position. Communication was key through all of this, and explaining the rationale to parents as to why we're only having 4 days of classes necessarily, and getting that message out to people was really, really important, and making sure there were no voids, no gaps there that people could create their own reality and start rumours and all that sort of thing. You had to make sure that you were filling that space with the actual simple rationale behind why we were doing things. And so communication really came to the fore through all of that as well.
Christine, your term three started very differently because you learnt as well from the first online learning experience.
We had, in our first lot of huddles, we had sort of thought the easiest thing was to pick up our in-class timetable and just change it over. And we realised very quickly that sitting there from 9 to 3 every day in front of a screen was not sustainable. And so we had started working on a different timetable. And so it had the pastoral engagement to start with each day, and then we had 4 one-hour blocks with big gaps in between, a bit like Andy was saying, to give people time to get away from the screens, to go and make their cup of coffee, to go and do whatever they needed to do. And we had the government had told us on the Monday we were shutting on the Tuesday. We used those first that first day of the Tuesday to set the teachers up, and then they moved the term holidays forward. So we actually basically had that week plus another 2 weeks before we had to go online full time. So we had quite a bit of time to actually tweak the timetable, get some more consensus, obviously all virtually, test it out with other people and see if it was going to work, and then we launched. But that gave us lots of time to communicate with the community and tell them why we were doing it, what we were doing it for. We did get some pushback because we halved the amount of face-to-face time. We did, everything was Zoom lessons. And what the teachers found was it was exhausting because they had to be a lot more deliberate and intentional with their planning, because you can be in a room and scan to see how something's going and pick out the people that aren't quite getting it. You can't do it quite as easily on a screen. So we had to really change what we were doing. But after the first week or two, we were getting feedback from people dropping in and out of people's classroom, virtual classrooms, asking people what they thought, and it was coming back very positive in that we also, one of the key messages we gave teachers was, whatever you're doing now, halve it and then take some more off, because we said you can't do everything that you're doing now in the classroom. You can't expect people to do it. You don't know what their bubble's like. Yeah, we had that idea of the bubble. You can't know what other people's bubbles like, especially with the teachers as well as with the students. So halve whatever you're doing and then take some more off it. And we had to push a little bit for some people who were still expecting, a bit like Philip said, you know, here's all the work that I was going to give you. I'm still going to give it to you. I'm going to talk you through it. But the innovation was hilarious. We had things like, you have a glass splashback on your stove. People were using that as their whiteboards. They were doing all sorts of innovative things just to sort of get the message across and being there in person. So having the face of the teacher there was really important, rather than just loading stuff up on the Google Classroom. Having the person in front of you and being able to respond in real time to people was really important about building that community and keeping those connections going.
And Heather, when I was speaking to you, what I really noted was that you focused on moving your school quickly through survival to thrival. And as it was, the adaptation was so good that you're doing full concerts and dance classes and music classes and all of the things that we thought would come later, you're doing them now. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yeah, so we were fortunate, Fiona, I guess, to have a really good look. We run flipped classrooms anyway, so we had, I guess our questions were around capacity, but it got to the stage where we didn't want to take a whole day and have kids online and at home with parents who were running businesses and, you know, also having the same level of stress around what was going to happen next. So we did a full online test in an evening over 3 hours in the evening, so that parents could be there with their children at the same time. And I guess that showed us that we had some capacity issues, so we expanded that. So when we when the lockdown was declared, as Christine said, we were able to, with the Wednesday, close the school down. We took that as a day, and then we went into full online learning, and we just kept our holidays where they were. So we just quite seamlessly moved into online learning. We'd already tested Microsoft Teams to make sure that we could regularly keep in contact with all of our staff, and also the staff were using Google Classrooms. And so it actually went relatively smoothly. And the sports people and the performing arts people were kind of concerned because, you know, they weren't necessarily part of regular classroom programs. So they came up with a whole range of fitness classes, ways in which students could undertake. They were being coached in various different sporting codes and how to keep fit while they were doing their online learning. So it was great. And when it got close to Anzac Day, one of our girls posted a beautiful video of her playing the last post. And so the idea was that we would all get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and play it in our whole neighbourhoods. And I could hear it ringing out around different areas of Auckland. So there wasn't anything really that we couldn't do. We still had our full school assemblies. We still had all of our staff meetings. And it was great to keep that whole community conversation happening through the parents at home with their girls as well. And every day, and I think quite a few people have spoken about the trust in the information that you're providing to the community. So we communicated every day with two pieces of information, really. One was a summary of all of the COVID data for the day, so that it went through how many cases we'd had here in New Zealand, what that all looked like. And we used various different sources to get that accurate information so that it was good, as you know, as accurate as we could. And we used SOS, Worldometer, the New Zealand health site, and also the World Health website to make sure that we could cross-check the information and ensure that it was correct. So I think we got up to parent email and information updates 71. And, you know, that I think that's what does create that confidence and trust in the community when they know that the information is coming to them on a regular basis, that it's accurate. And the other side of that information was the impact on the school, you know, our expectations of girls and parents. And we also found, too, that it was very intense. And so we had to pull back on the level of intensity of the program so that less time was taken with the online interaction and more gaps were provided for students to actually do the follow-up and do the work. And that also provided a break for all of the teaching staff as well.
And Anthony Elmore, I'm going to ask you to do two things. Give us a snapshot on your experience of online learning and then outline the challenges that you see you'll need to solve at your school in the next 6 months. What do you think will be the pressing issues? Either you know them or you can see them looming.
All right, thanks, Fiona. A brief sort of overview or snapshot of our approach. Being part of a system of 144 schools, we are very lucky that we have been using Teams since January 2019. So when the time came for our students to be learning at home, it was a fairly seamless transition in that regard for our community, for our staff and for our students, which was good. We did, though, have the opportunity that we had probably 2 weeks leading into the Easter holidays where our staff were able to do some additional preparation and really, I suppose, the expectation that we had at that time was that staff would prepare work for the whole of term two because we didn't know what was going to happen from there. The approach we took was absolutely around flexibility. We knew that following your regular timetable was not going to be sustainable within our community and not sustainable for our staff either. So we took the approach that we only required the teachers to be in a, I suppose, online, but face-to-face online for one lesson across their timetable in the week, and the other time they would be available online through online chat or emails and things like that. The issue of trust has come up a few times. I think a few people have mentioned it. And I think for us, the key around establishing very clearly that good relationship and maintaining those good relationships was being clear about our expectations and the expectations that we had of our staff, but also the expectations on students and families. And similar to Philip's experience, we produced a document called Expectations to Support Learning Continuity in an Online Platform or on an online platform. So we didn't call it online learning or e-learning or anything like that. It was about the continuity of learning, but in this online platform. We ended up about four different revisions of that over the time that we were away from traditional schooling through feedback from the community, feedback from teachers, feedback from students and parents. In that document, what we did, we spelt out very clearly what the expectations of teachers were. So when we spoke to the families from the very beginning, we said teachers will do, and then we listed that. And so there was high levels of accountability. And then we very clearly explained what the expectation of students was. For us, we knew that parents were not expected to overnight become teachers, and that was a very consistent message in our communication to families. The teachers weren't suddenly going to be sitting at home, parents weren't suddenly going to become teachers. And so we talked about how the school would support the parents to support their students in their continuity of learning. And that was in that document as well. So, in that way, we relieved a lot of pressure. And that was a lot of the feedback we got from families, that they felt very supported, that we weren't expecting that they would be driving the program, that the school was doing that with their accountability with the students. And the way we did that, we had daily pastoral check-ins, but it wasn't an expectation that every student had to be online, you know, at 8:30 every morning. We had the expectation that students would check in with us by 10:30 every morning and give us a rating of how they were feeling, how they were going with their online learning. And if their rating fell below a certain level, we would make contact directly with that student and contact with their parent. And so we did that each week that we were out of the college as well. And then we, one thing that our families have highly valued, and again, this is about that relationships and connections, we called every family once a week just to check in to say, how are you travelling? How are you going? And is there anything the college can do to support you? And that was a big undertaking, but that, I suppose we need to be mindful that here for us in Queensland, all the staff were still at school. It was only the students that were away. So the staff were still here. And so our school officers that traditionally would be occupied with the walk-ins had that opportunity to do that. And so contacting every family every week was great to just check to see how everyone was travelling in relation to that. And so really making sure that learning was happening in a sustainable way, not expecting the same levels as every panellist has talked about already, really paring back some of those expectations there, but having that continuity happening was something we had to keep an eye on.
What's the road ahead? What do you see as the challenges? And I know you did say to me, Anthony, that a large proportion of your parent body have lost employment and lost income by nature of working in hospitality and tourism, and that being key industry sectors on the Gold Coast. Yeah. I would have thought school fees and maintaining enrolments and community well-being is top of the list, but maybe you can tell us.
I think the two
key things for us is looking at how we can maintain flexibility in our learning and teaching delivery for our families, and that communication, maintaining those high levels of communication. Obviously, what we were doing during that period was unsustainable because it was daily, if not sometimes twice daily, detailed communications going out. We can't sustain that. So, but still, how do we maintain really detailed communication to families about what's happening and what's going on? You did pick up then on the financial implications, and we have been dealing with a significant volume of concessions. So for us, it's, I suppose for every school, it's about making sure that we support families through this because, you know, what's happened to so many of our families, it's through no fault of their own. They woke up one morning and their workplaces were shut. Their businesses immediately lost, you know, up to 70% of business available to them. And so for us, it's being respectful to those families about respecting their dignity, about maintaining that very positive outlook of being hope-filled, and supporting those families in their enrolment here at our college till things become, you know, stronger for them financially. There will be families that will drift away, but for us it's about how do we maintain that connection support for those families and also, you know, what's our capacity to continue to offer ongoing concession
greater than what we already offer for families. But we're doing well in that regard at the moment, and we'll continue to support our families here. But that, for us, one of the great things that's come out of this is really looking at the positive feedback from the community about the flexibility, particularly in year 11 and 12. And so for us now, for next year, looking at a specific middle leadership role holder to talk about future pathways or that future flexibility, how can we reimagine 11 and 12, so the senior years at the college, and how do we look at incorporating greater flexibility? Because we've seen how so many students have thrived during that period. How do we look at year 11 and 12 differently to what has traditionally happened here at the college?
Sounds exciting. Andy Muller at Scotch Oakburn, what is the road ahead for your decisions you need to make in the next 6 months? What do you see looming ahead for you?
I think recognising that this is actually going to last for quite a while, regardless of the COVID situation and its prevalence in our community, we're going to be feeling the effects of this for the next 18 months, 2 years, whatever the case may be. So making sure that we get all of our community through this, through things such as Anthony's mentioned about the rebates and the concessions and the supporting those people who really need it. Some of the challenges for us as we sort of look to the next 6 months, say, at this stage, because things are changing so rapidly, I'm not sure that we should be waste our time thinking for too much further than that. But picking up on the changes and the flexibility and the capability that people have actually got, and making sure that they don't fall back into just the same old habits, but we actually pick out the good little bits that we found through all of this, and making sure that our staff start to incorporate those. Again, as Anthony mentioned, looking at the senior year levels and saying, well, this is quite possibly a way of the future. There's a good rationale for saying every student at some stage in those last 2 or 3 years of school should study a subject online, because most of our students go to university, most of them are studying online. This is the preparation that they need for that next stage once they move beyond our gates. So challenges with expectation as well, of what can be achieved. We've got some families who their son or daughter is would prefer to stay at home. Maybe there's somebody in a vulnerable position at home, and so they don't want students coming back and forth to school. So they're in a particular situation, and the expectation that, well, you can continue to deliver your e-learning platform whilst the teacher is teaching the class. And that's not always feasible, depending on the technology you've got and the type of class. So there's all of those sorts of things that are challenges for us. And importantly, identifying those new opportunities that are going to be presenting themselves, and making sure that we can take hold of those whilst recognising that there's a fair bit of change fatigue with our staff, especially at the moment, many of whom... I had feedback from one staff member who was so proud of what they'd achieved, never thought that they were going to be able to use technology to this level, and sort of obviously really buoyed by what they had done, but saying that they never want to do this again. And so being aware that some staff are fatigued simply from the change and that they've had to go through. So there's some real challenges for us in the next 6 months to be innovative, but at a measured pace. Hastening forward slowly, I think.
Thank you, Andy. Christine Allen at Carmel College, what is the road ahead look like for you? What are some of the things you're going to have to solve?
Well, I think like Andy, we're quite cognizant of the fact that we don't want people just falling back into the same old that they used to, because it's so easy to fall back into the familiar. And while we realise that that change fatigue is setting in, and people had to do an awful lot of stuff very, very quickly, and it was quite exhausting, we want to actually look at possibilities that people had never even thought might be a possibility. So we're looking at things like in the timetable, and I don't even know, in the timetable that we made, if there were gaps in the timetable for people that we made in the 4-hour blocks, I labelled it independent learning time. And that was to allow students to do whatever they needed to do to catch up. And so that is a term that students are really looking for. They said we really valued having a time where we could just do what we needed to do rather than what the teacher was teaching us at the time. Give us the work and let us do some stuff and do it in the time frames that we needed to do it in. So we're looking at how do we incorporate that into our normal programs. We're looking at chunking up the times into longer periods of time. How do we actually do that? Looking at that tension between, it's not possible, I don't think, for a teacher to be teaching in class and online simultaneously, but how can we come to some, you know, sort of waypoint where we might be able to do part of each and offer other alternatives for actually students being in the classroom. And so we continued to explore and think about these ideas. We've got a big new building project going ahead and we've paused all of that because we're saying, what does this new experience mean for us in terms of what is it we actually want to do? And then we build the environment to enable us to do it in rather than let's just build it and then we have to do what we've always done. So there's some really good thinking going on and just gathering ideas and listening to other people, but making sure we keep the momentum going without just slipping back to what we did and pretend that that online thing was something terrible and will never happen again and we don't have to even think about it again. Because I think, as other panelists are saying, is even though in New Zealand at the moment we're, so long as we keep our borders shut, we're sort of pretty much back to normal. How it might come back again in another form at another time. How do we actually plan for that and sort of incorporate that into our daily life?
And Heather McRae at Diocesan School for Girls, what is the road ahead for you? What do the next 6 months look like?
I think when we came back to school, it was quite interesting because there was kind of a level of nervousness around, well, this year we've missed out. So it was dealing with the feeling that this year was going to be very different. So to address that level of, uncertainty about the future, we developed a saying which was around, you know, we haven't missed out on learning and we haven't lost time. We've just spent it differently. Mm-hmm. And we've learned differently, and let's make sure that we take the example of that learning differently into our daily lives and our expectations for learning in the future. So for a start, the level of teacher PD that happened over that time was extraordinary. Even in the most, all of the change strategy books written by Fallon and Hargraves and their colleagues, you can say that there's always got to be a carrot and a stick in terms of professional development, a reason to actually create it. So the good news about COVID is it created that reason for teachers to really engage with online learning and with the technologies that are there to support and assist them. And the growth that happened during that time has been phenomenal and something that I know anybody watching will also be celebrating. Because it is a fantastic occasion to see that level of PD happening in such a short period of time. We've learned a lot about the road ahead and some things that we learned. And at the moment, I know schools in Australia will probably have the same thing, that every year there's a fairly large expense that goes to covering teachers who are ill at home or who have children who are ill at home. But what we've discovered is that many of our teachers can now teach from home while they are looking after a child and still do that very successfully, you know, thus protecting their sick leave and also enabling teachers to think differently about how and where they work. So that's been a real benefit. The other thing is that we normally run course selection evenings here at school where, parents will come in and talk with their teenagers about their course selections and where they're heading. And so what we've done now is done that whole thing online. So all of the faculties have now uploaded information about their courses. So it's all electronic now. They can go in, they can select, they can request a meeting or an interview, or they can, ask questions and do all that online. So the way in which we present information to our community too has also changed. And as well, I think it's been great for us to look at the same as a couple of people have mentioned around senior courses for years 12 and 13, and looking at options that we might build into their programs. And also to keep going with online learning. A lot of teachers have been teaching online while they are in class and at school. Really just to give the students that experience and to make sure that we are continuing with that experience with them and not just dropping it, because there was such a lot that they learned from it as well. So those are the ways that we've looked at going forward. And, you know, we are optimistic that we can continue reasonably effectively in an online environment, although in the surveys our students have very much said they much prefer learning at school with bits of online learning. So it is interesting, because as has been mentioned, it's that social engagement, and the staff also really missed each other over that time. And it was so lovely in those few weeks we were back to really celebrate being back together. And to celebrate the achievement and to share some of the feedback that we'd had from our community that I know many of your schools in Australia would also have received. And I think it's been, an amazing experience for us all.
And Philip Heath at Barker College, what do you see as the road ahead? We know that you have a big sports event coming up this weekend. What are some of the things you have to solve within the next 6 months at Barker College?
Yeah, I think there's several there, Fiona. One is, I don't think we're sufficiently at the end of the road to know how we can look back across the landscape. I still feel that we're still on this pilgrimage, if you will. But that said, building community has been unbelievably difficult this year, because by definition, our main priority is to keep the needle on the risk management dial at low and low to medium. And so as a consequence of that, we've made decisions about not having face-to-face events at school. Like other colleagues, we've had lots of online streamed concerts and events and meetings, and some of those have been great. And some of those have been quite liberating. In fact, there's many ways in which we're thinking about reforming how we're doing parent-teacher experiences generally, and how we're allowing our parents to interact with the school. But there is nevertheless a loss of the togetherness that you don't just enroll in a school, you join it, you belong to it, you enter it, enter its life, and we have denied that. You know, the other day it was a little practice match happening on. I noticed it was a netball game, and I noticed parents were peering through the glass to watch the game. And I felt so awful, really, but that we'd made this decision that we don't have people on site. So actually, one of the things that's really going to be a challenge, apart from all the technical ones and the reform of learning and taking up some of the really exciting opportunities that this challenge has created for us, and taking all the positive mindset that comes with growth, is actually how do we rebuild our people and celebrate safely being back together again in ways that don't lose the benefit of what's just happened or is happening. And right at the heart of that is the connection. You know that CPR little acronym, you know, connect, protect, respect. How do we make sure when we're not as connected, or at least we are connected virtually, that we've got the other two, protect and respect, still safely in place? I think as the roadmap takes us down that way, how do we equip our people really well to do that? And to nourish them. The other big takeaway for me, and this is a little confession time, but I've probably over the years been taking the view that staff wellbeing is a nice to have, but student wellbeing is the main game. And I can understand why that is a view, but I've actually reformed that over the last few years, shifted quite significantly to take the view that the thriving of the staff will lead to the thriving of the children, not the always the other way around. And listening to what they're saying and hearing their concerns. I read recently that lovely book, Utopia for Realists, and taking a quite different view about the usual pupil-teacher task and staff management as opposed to leadership task, what is a reformed school looking like in the future? That's out of the embers of this incendiary experience we've all experienced. I think some of the regeneration could look like that if we were brave enough.
Thank you, everybody. We allocated an hour for this and we've run over. But if you're amenable, I'll distribute the questions that have come in and maybe you can just type into a document and we can distribute those out to all the registrants. Thank you so much today. You've all been a beacon of hope and light and stability for your communities. There will be people in your community that you don't know. You probably don't know the story, but they will have kept on going because you were their safe voice. And I thank all of you for being that, and every single principal across the country who's been that too. You mean a lot to communities and schools. And schools, as schools where people come to classrooms, they really matter. They matter to us. So thank you so much. Christine Allen at Carmel College in New Zealand, thank you. Heather McRae at Diocesan School for Girls, thank you. Anthony Elmore from St Michael's College at Merrimack on the Gold Coast, thank you. Andy Muller from Scotch Oakburn at Launceston in Tasmania, thank you. And Philip Heath, thank you for kicking it all off with writing beautiful communication to your community and keeping them safe and together from Barker College. Thank you, and thank you so much.
This podcast is brought to you by EdSmart. The producer is Anushay Khan. The editor is Stephen Baker. And if you'd like to make contact with us at EdSmart, email info@edsmart.com.